Hi, everyone. This is Gary welcoming you to the LL Research Radio program In the Now, Q&A with Carla and crew. Today is Tuesday, June 10th, 2014. Carla L. Ruckert is an author, mystic seeker, and primary channel for LL Research. The crew in the title refers to those of us at the LL Center, beginning with Jim McCarty, Carla's husband, scribe for the Raw Contact, and president of LL Research. Austin and I, devoted seekers of the Law of One, manage LL from the home office, though Austin is not with us today, so it's just Jim, Carla, and myself. LL Research is a nonprofit organization dedicated to freely sharing spiritually oriented information and fostering community, and towards this end has two websites, the archive website, llresearch.org, and the community website, bringforth.org. We will be discussing questions that come from you. If you would like to ask us a question live on the air, please call 646-595-2294 and press the 1 key when prompted. If interested in submitting a question when we're not on air, please visit our show's webpage at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. When submitting questions, please remember that this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Gary, and we're talking with Carla L. Ruckert and the home crew of LL Research. Jim and Carla, are you on board and ready?
Ready to go.
Indeed.
All right. Well, we'll start today's show with a channeling that comes from April 6, 2003. Quo says, "The Creator, in its infinity, in its impossibility of being described, is a vibration. You have that original vibration, which is unconditional love, as the basis of every cell of your being. Without that thought of love, has nothing been made that is made. It is not something you possess. It is your very nature. It goes far deeper than the marrow of your bones. It is far closer to you than your breathing. It is far more real than the impressions of sense. For it is that impulse and spark without which you could not take thought, take breath, or enjoy existence or consciousness. This nature of the principle of deity is the heart of you, is the truth of you."
Thank you, Gary. Whoever heard of us being a vibration before Ra, I didn't think about that much. After the Ra contact, I thought about it a lot because Ra started out with saying that we are all thoughts dancing in a ballroom until such time as we have no more distortions that cause us to dance. I never heard a better description of the ins and outs of the relationships between men and women especially, but between all of us. We dance. Sometimes very clumsily, sometimes with grace. Sometimes it makes us happy. Sometimes that interaction makes us profoundly unhappy. And we have catalysts. We have pain. People hurt people. I'm not sure why that is, but time, even inadvertently, sometimes we don't intend to hurt each other, but we do. It's almost inevitable. We will hurt each other. Doggone it. Why is that so? Oh, heavenly days, why is that so? Why can I not be harmless? But the more self-conscious I get about trying to be harmless, the more I'm going to hurt someone. You know that. It's impossible. Heaven knows we try not to hurt each other for the most part. Now, there are times when I have profoundly wished to hurt somebody else. Oh, my goodness, yes. I have thought of different ways of murdering them. burning them, twisting their necks off, smashing their faces in. Oh, my goodness. I don't much like that part of myself, but there it is. Needless to say, these things don't get out from behind my teeth, or they don't come out into action. But it's so relieving to think that while we're listening to somebody we don't want to listen to go on and on about something we don't care about. And somehow this happens more often than I would like. Even our voices as we speak to each other, our vibrations, tones, that can only be described as vibrations. Some voices are pleasant, some are harsh. It's always unfortunate to hear someone with a real nasty, harsh voice, you know, like that. Or many other ways of misusing speech. I wish we tried harder to make it all pleasant. But most of us are not at all aware of that aspect of life. Have no idea what they sound like. Would be surprised, I say. Every cell holds a vibration of love. That can only be because the Creator is love, creates us in love, has no idea how to do anything but create love out of itself. It is profoundly a thought of love, so much so that when it decided to find out more about itself and created us all in a universe that was made of love, we also were made of love. That's what holds us together, that vibration. I know the Hindus or the, oh, Gary, what am I looking for? The ones that feel that if you said Om in just the perfect way, we would all fall apart and the universe would disappear.
I think you would find that within a Buddhist tradition.
Buddhist tradition, okay, that's what I thought. Couldn't think of the word.
And Hindu.
Okay, well, good. Well, you know, that only becomes possible if you look at one overriding principle that makes us all one. And that one overriding principle is love. So only there does it make sense that it's a vibration of love spoken perfectly were to be uttered, the universe would disappear. Wouldn't that be something? I think that there are places in this world where Om is practiced daily, hourly, around the clock. I wonder if somebody all gets it right, will we know? Or will we just poof? I don't know. The point is that we have no respect sometimes for ourselves or our voices. And we need to have respect and esteem for how we sound and what words we use to speak with each other. We can always improve the lovingness of our speech, tone of it, the words used, the energy behind it, certainly. I try to do that, and I hope you all will too. May the Spirit help us all. Amen.
Amen. Little internet research. discovered that Om is a mantra and mystical Sanskrit sound of Hindu origin, sacred and important in various Dharmic religions such as Hinduism, Buddhism, and Jainism. So there you have it. So, moving on to our first question that comes from Carlos C. via Facebook, submitted on June 7th. Carlos writes, can you explain the concept slash relationship of the, quote, Father in the Christian Trinity and the human, quote, imagination? I thought this would be a good one for Carla.
Okay. Well, thinking about it, I decided that there wasn't much of a relationship at all between the Father in the Trinity and imagination. I would put it more in the Son or even the Spirit. And in the raw context, it would be the Mother, which holds both the Spirit and the Son in its folds. Because the Creator created a universe out of itself and created it as itself, a reflection of itself. Exactly. Not much imagination there. Beauty, certainly. Grace. Loveliness. But imagination, I think, as the Mother is responsible for every breath we take and basically the manifestation of things, how they're arranged and how they reflect back upon the principle of love. I think I would give that energy to the Mother. I see a lot of imagination in the teachings of Jesus the Christ in terms of the Trinity, which he asked about. And much imagination also in the work of the Spirit. I would give imagination to those two energies and to the Mother in terms of the raw contact.
I didn't quite get where the question would be coming from that would try to draw a connection between the Trinity and Christian theology and imagination. It would really help to know why, to help explicate that question.
Yeah, that baffled me too. I couldn't find a universal principle behind those questions. What possessed him to link those three things?
Yeah, I was hoping that you could expand on what the Father signifies in that Trinity as a response to Carlos that would help be, you know, somewhat informative.
Well, no, because in the Christian theology, the creator of the world is the Father. Again, he creates a world out of himself. And again, there is not imagination in that act. There is the need to go to Spirit in order to breathe life into this creation that was, you know, there. The Bible says that the Spirit moved over the waters and they were formed, and that's the work of I would say of Spirit, you know. It gives it specifically to Spirit in Genesis. And I can't think of anywhere in the Bible where the Father, Creator God, and imagination are linked. So I'm baffled. I'm totally baffled. Nor can I find any relationship in terms of raw. or in terms of anything or anybody that ever, you know, tried to make a cosmology.
Yes, even to the limits of my imagination, I'm on the same page.
How about you, Gary? Could you do anything with that?
Do you mean to say direct that to Jim?
You couldn't, huh? Mickey, how about you?
Well, I was thinking about the omission of the Christian traditions of the mother. I guess the female portion of creation has been discriminated against in all its forms throughout all of creation. But if the father-mother aspect could be seen as a unity in the Christian tradition, then we could say that imagination could have a relationship to the father in that respect, and that it was the father was the other portion that moved and helped to create the creation. And it seems like the imagination has to come in there somewhere when you're making a creation. I think because there really is a blending of positive and negative in father and mother, there's an ability to create that wouldn't be there if it really did just have the father and there was no female portion to it. So I think there's a relationship, but you have to add the mother onto the father aspect before the relationship becomes apparent.
All right, moving on to Casey Gale's question, submitted via Bring Forth. She says, Jane Roberts said the crucifixion was not an actual event in the physical realms, but was an event in the non-physical realms. Can or will you comment or explain this in any way?
I could believe that. Apparently it was an historical event. I mean, there's been a lot of evidence through the many centuries that people have dug up, times okay, sometimes really stretching, but evidential things, reference to it in other works mostly, as a done thing, it happened. However, if it did not happen that way, if it was a metaphysical event, that would make sense too. It's what Jesus wanted to do. So, using his, shall we say, imagination. He would have pondered that, hoped for that, seen that happening, visualizing it, wanting it badly. Whether it's a physical event or a metaphysical one, and certainly it's both. It's a profound change in the history of the world. When you think of the way everything goes from the conduct of war to the development of philosophy, it's a necessary event. It couldn't have happened any other way. That event, however it happened, impacted the world, both physically and in the world of thought, through the centuries, and still impacts the world. Jesus is still a representative of the forces of light. And I think because of Jesus, the idea of evil and overcoming evil are right in his story. He is tempted by the devil. There it is. And he says, no. The devil says, I'll give you the world. I'll give you everything I've got. You'll be king of the world as long as people are alive. I'll just have them after they're dead. Jesus said, uh-uh, no, I won't do that. My kingdom is not of this world. You can have the world. I have all else but this little physical dance that is so short for all of us. Whereas the world of goodness, positivity, it goes on forever. Fullness of time, according to the raw contact, goodness learns to include all aspects of evil in its formation, becoming mature and holding all things within one. Yet that one thing was a thought of love, the only way it worked, according to Ra. And that makes sense to me. I like that cosmology, and I can find no fault with it. Guys?
Regarding like the historicity of the crucifixion, anything that Ra says would not be proof or authentic to most of the world, but to those of us who enjoy the law of one material, we tend to find Ra a credible source on things. And in 75.14, Don is asking about the psychic greeting or psychic attack that Carla experienced while singing the Benedictus portion of the music that she's singing at church. And
Mass in B minor by Bach.
Mass in B minor. And so Ra explains what happens and what Carla experienced, rather. And in Ra's explanation, they talk about the actual history of Jehoshua. Am I saying that? Jehoshua? Would that be the right way to say that?
Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
Jehoshua.
Jehoshua, I think, but you don't hit the way we do.
Yeah.
Jehoshua.
So Ra says, Yehoshua came into the place of its martyrdom. So martyrdom implies that Jesus did meet his death somewhat in accordance with the story about Jesus. And Ra speaks of Yehoshua's riding into Jerusalem. Maybe Ra's just examining the music here, but I believe that they're talking about to what actually transpired.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Further reinforcing the idea in my head that there was an actual crucifixion is that the Roman Empire used that as a form of capital punishment, and especially for enemies of the state. And I think Jesus in his time might have qualified for that particular sentence. So it seems likely that that happened, but of course it's unverifiable at this present juncture. But as I liked what you said, Carla, about it being both historical and metaphysical, because on the metaphysical level, it's hugely symbolic of the seeker's journey, whereas, as I interpret it, the cross is used to signify the burdens we carry, the challenges we have to face. There's the expression to carry your cross, to make your sacrifices. So it's a symbol, as I interpret it, of sacrifice, but ultimately in the mystical sense, and when you take it to the level of Christhood, what's being sacrificed is the ego self, the separate self, the small I upon that cross is dying, and then as in correlation with the Christian story of Jesus, what is resurrected is the eternal self, the self that is one with God and has transcended body and mind. I think that happens, or the Jesus story is symbolic of what can happen for the seeker in terms of the seeker's own death and rebirth, not a physical death necessarily in a physical sort of resurrection 3 days later from a tomb, but in terms of realizing the self and dropping the illusions. So in that respect, then, I could see it as a not an actual event, but as a metaphysical one.
Yes. Just as a matter of a note here, I see the cross as symbolic when Jesus resurrected. So I am a resurrection Christian, and I call myself that.
What do you mean by its emptiness?
Well, Jesus wasn't on the cross anymore, right?
Mm-hmm.
He had transcended the cross, so it was empty.
Yeah, once its act of transformation has been fulfilled, then I guess you set it aside. There's no need for the cross any longer.
Well, I mean, the cross is a good symbol. I mean, it's very universal, and it's one of the most simple, you know, the X, if you turn it sideways, is one of the most universal marks made. So it's inevitable that it come into use as symbolic of something or other.
Mm-hmm.
But I wish that people would allow it to become symbolic of the resurrection rather than put the body on it and have it bleeding, you know, the way they do on the Catholic cross with a body on it and, you know, it's a gross, you know, horrid expressions of agony on Jesus' face and, you know, really pounding it in there that it's just horrible and full of suffering, and that's not what Jesus wanted to show at all. It's a complete other meaning than Jesus ever intended for the cross. He intended to see people, to have people see him leave it and leap upwards into the air, into the mists of eternity. But no, you know, that cross with the corpus, which is the usual Catholic cross, Roman Catholic cross, nails it to earth. And as you said, you know, you just automatically think of that meaning and not the other, and that it could only be metaphysical in that other meaning. Yet Jesus intended for that other meaning, I think. And I certainly never have won an argument that way with Christians, so I don't argue. But that's what I think. And I think that there is some biblical evidence that would make my thinking reasonable.
So you're saying the Mel Gibsons of the world are missing the point?
Yeah, just a bit, like 180 degrees. You know, so that Jesus is nailed down into being king of the world, which he never wanted, and not of this world. And Jesus specifically said, "My kingdom is not of this world," and everything in the theology of suffering forgets that he said that. They have to forget it. I don't see how they could include it. Mickey, what do you think?
Well, I've seen the cross as a symbol of sacrifice, and I think that that's what people are looking at when they see Jesus on the cross, seeing him sacrificing his life for the benefit and welfare of the human spirit or the human soul. I don't know why, as you say, Carla, the Roman Catholic Church would want to primarily on that when you know, as great an act as that was, how much greater is the fact that he was resurrected and he survived that death process, and that sacrifice, in effect, was as nothing compared to what was gained, you know, the waters of eternal life. And this little life here that seems to have been lost, it was just a tiny little drop in an ocean of eternity. So I don't know why people would want to focus on that, but I think that the cross is a very good way of expressing sacrifice. The upward-reaching beam that goes vertically and reaches towards infinity crosses eventually the horizontal beam of this world and penetrates it and goes beyond it, which is exactly what Jesus did. So that's my thought.
And riffing on Jim's reply, which hits on the what Ra described of the crux ansara, which is, you know, very much connected to the cross, and Jim
it's
mentioned
the ankh, guys. It's a cross, except it's got a little round loop, and it's mostly seen as an Egyptian symbol.
And Jim hit the principal points of what Ra says of this symbol. And to quote Ra, they say, "We may indicate that the crux ansara is a part of the concept complexes of the archetypical mind, the circle indicating the magic of the spirit, the cross indicating that nature of manifestation which may only be valued by the losing. Thus, the crux ansara is intended to be seen as an image of the eternal in and through manifestation and beyond manifestation through the sacrifice and transformation of that which is manifest."
Yeah, it's beautiful. It gets right to it. You know, it's funny. I've always said I don't care whether Jesus did or didn't resurrect, you know, physically. All I care about is the look in his eyes on that cross. The love in his eyes. And I follow that love. I don't follow some story. I follow that love. And it's just a look of the eye, the beam of the eye, and it holds everything to me.
It's interesting. We got we've been in contact with a Spanish individual named Manuel from Spain who's interested in translating the LL material into Spanish, and he sent a link yesterday for channeling from Yehoshua. I think the URL is yehoshua.net. And so I was perusing that yesterday and reading one of their channel transcripts about healing, and supposedly the alleged source of the channeling is Yehoshua, or perhaps just one representing his vibration. And anyways, he's discussing his time on Earth and how he went about his business and describes healing. And he says it wasn't so much, if I'm remembering this correctly, it wasn't so much a particular technique or something that he did per se, but rather it was his eyes. It was the energy, or the divine, more or less, mm-hmm. coming through his eyes.
How about that? Well, I found another person in this world that thinks the way I do. What do you know about that?
Yeah, when I read it yesterday,
satisfying.
I thought about you immediately because of what you described of your childhood experience with
yes.
Jesus looking into his eyes.
The age of two or three, you know, I was set for life. I don't think too many people have the luxury of knowing what they're doing. I mean, in terms of, you know, basic energy, the energy of the life pattern. I will serve. I will serve that love in his eyes, that energy. So I never questioned that. And I never had any agony except that during my religious period, my agony had to do with the fact that I could never achieve likeness to that. I could never get there. And I was a fool, you know, and that really bothered me. And I got over it.
This is kind of a double-edged sword in that regard. I think that is a gift, especially at 2 or 3 years old, because in my mid-30s, I'm still trying to crystallize that same sort of certainty. I think I'm strong on my own path, of course. I've been following my lights for a long time, but I haven't had that sort of inner conviction that is unassailable from by doubt, mm-hmm. per se. Doubt mm-hmm. still wins the day in my own case.
Yeah, there's gnosis rather than knowledge in my awareness. You know, that gnosis that is held in opposition to knowledge. It's not learning, it's not knowing, it's grokking, it's a knowing that is forever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my knowing. And I'm so grateful for that, because I've been spared so much, and I've gained gifts of incalculable value all through my life, because I did not have that aspect of agonizing search. You know, it was search from rest. You know, how can I understand it better? How can I be better? You know, but still, you know, always the center held for me. To misquote the poet in his turning and turning in a widening gyre, the falcon cannot see the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. It's a beautiful, terrible poem slouching towards Bethlehem. Yeats, I think, right? Anybody know it?
I believe you're right.
Yeah. Good. I always get these things wrong, but I really love that poem, and it's so powerful in terms of how this guy was working with that same energy. Was it knowledge or was it gnosis? Could the falcon see the falconer no matter where it went? Did it lose track when it flew too far from home?
Yeah, I think that's a poignant way to describe both the way that you and Jim both have lived your life in terms of the center will hold mm-hmm. or does hold. I definitely notice that I'm rocked about in stormy mental seas, and there's always, I think that I never completely lose center. It's always there, but sometimes it's a slippery rock to try to hold on to in tumultuous seas. But I think you guys are better planted in that center, no matter what weather may bring. Well, in trying to best manage our time, it's 1:40, so I think I'm going to skip the next couple of smaller questions and go to our meatiest question of today's episode, and it's on the back side of both of your papers.
I never turned it over.
Surprise.
You have to look on both sides of the page, Rock. Oh. Okay, I'll read it now. Why don't you read it to us?
So, Tyrus says via Facebook on June 7th, my question is simple. How does one heal the heart and enter the kingdom of heaven already present? Lots of Christian themes today. How do we bring forth what is within us to save us? How do we get from the place of lack and fear programming to full presence and joy?
I guess the simple answer is the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. You know, start taking some steps and stay faithful.
Now, the first step to me is meditation. If you enter the silence, you are entering the kingdom of truth, and things will come to you. The more you pray that the Spirit will help you, the more that will happen. The Spirit is very willing. But as, what's his name? Tyrus. Lovely name. As Tyrus frames it, the heart is already there. The kingdom of heaven is already present. And the kingdom of heaven is within the silence. And I think that's what the birth of Jesus was all about. I see myself as a supplicant in the cross. I mean, in the straw of that stable. And I am kneeling before the baby. And I am the baby. I become the baby. And I'm a very young Christ. And I don't know how it goes yet. And I have to listen. To listen through time. Because it goes away. It slips away, as Gary said. It's a slippery rock to stand on. Until finally you do achieve gnosis and you know. But I think that only comes with silence. It doesn't come with words. Words can inspire you, but then you need to take them into the silence. If you want to nail something to yourself, if you want to own it, you've got to meditate on it, I think. I don't know of anything else to tell the Tyrus. I watch people thrashing about reading this and reading that, trying this practice and trying that, going for endless weekends of healing and learning. And, you know, just thrashing about in the seas of confusion. When right within them, their very being is that which they seek. I know Gary is much devoted to the practice of meditation. And I hope it may bring you gnosis, Gary. I think that is a wonderful practice for you to do, however you do it. And to use our gardens as a way of meditating is, to me, it makes the gardens so spiritual, you know. And I'm so happy to see you working that. You know, I saw you, Jim said he saw you one day out there having a meditation of the garden, you know, letting the garden come into you, walking that path that I conceived and Jim made, which is sort of an outpouring of the way the spirit works with manifestation. You know, I had the idea and then Jim made it happen. Without both things, it would never have come into being.
So that's where imagination comes into play.
Yeah, that's where imagination comes into play, for sure.
Yeah, the gardens, I've done some walking meditations out there, and they are ideally suited for meditations because there's just this perfect, a path of perfect width made of bricks. It isn't just a straight line from point A to point B, but it's curved gently, and it moves through. Even in a small, fairly relatively small place, it moves through beautiful scenery so that one second you're walking by an enormous tree that's been there for who knows how long, decades at least, past a stone cross and then past flowers that Jim has so lovingly planted. And it's just the whole ambiance of the experience is really beautiful and conducive to slowing down and being with your experience in that moment. I try to get out there more often, but the seat seems to have glue underneath it or on top of it, and it's hard to get away from the computer.
Yeah, you work so hard.
Yeah, right.
But when I had the idea and I told it to Jim, I said I want you to include, you know, as many plantings as you can. Because to me, any one of them is just a miracle. You can sit and look at any one of those plantings that Jim's made with stone and imagination. and created so that the flowers could grace it. And over the years, you know, everything's sort of matured and come into the fullness of his imagination
mm-hmm.
for it. But it doesn't include them all, but it includes a good many of the plantings.
Yeah, it's a perfect way for the earth to speak. It's a perfect marriage between human sweat and effort and design and creativity and the natural world. And it's very vibrant and multifaceted, but each facet is in harmony with each other facet in the yard. So there's a song in your yard.
Mm-hmm.
In the place
I love that. Yeah, I think so too.
You guys have built. In responding to Tyrus's question, it's always these questions are tough for me, and I'm going to be more self-referential today again because first and foremost, I'm definitely a work in progress who has not emphatically not solved the puzzle of my own self. So, like, I go through self-doubt in terms of what can I offer when I'm so confused, and I know that I'm not the only one who thinks that way. And then secondly, because when I consider these questions, I have conflicting impulses. One impulse is to respond in great quantity because there's so much to say, to be complete or, you know, try to be complete and really describe in detail the roadmap I'm attempting to share. But the downside of that is that you risk bogging your reply down with too many words and too many concepts and you make it overly complex and perhaps make it more difficult to be received. And you don't want to come across as preachy either. But then the opposite impulse, to keep it simple, pithy even, is there. And I think that our actual experience of truth, the awareness of all that there is radically and profoundly and unbelievably simple. I think one of the primary reasons that infinity seems to escape our attention and seems to be outside, quote-unquote, our experience, is that it's too simple. Our time-bound, complex minds completely overlook it as we juggle and sift through these endless realms of words and thoughts and symbols and finite identities. But then, keeping it simple in my mind, and it were a simple answer to be given, I think that meditation is one of the best ways to reduce it, or starting with what Jim said, focusing on the will. Desire it, seek it, intend it, and then let the universe respond. But then in giving a simple answer, it's also the downside to me is that you're not, you run the risk.
You lose the human experience if you don't make it complex. The human experience is profoundly complex.
Yeah, that's what I actually, Carla, is what I was going, you hit the nail on the head, that's what I was going to get at, and say, like, when you're being simple, then you feel like you're not providing sufficient access points or bridges
mm-hmm.
for the mind that's soaked in third density reality. And then a simple answer sometimes doesn't feel adequate to the task. So, for better or worse, I often can't help myself and err on the side of the line.
Well, I think that's what people are looking for, actually, who are using words to ask the questions. They're looking for words. And so that's good that you have the impulse to talk at length, because only at length, I think, can you... Why don't you go ahead and expatiate a bit on this, because I'd be interested in some of the completeness of what you're thinking.
I think there's different needs. Some people would absolutely prefer simplicity. But to be complex, I would first like commend Tyrus for the inclusion of the concept of already in his question, because we are the truth that we seek. Who we are is already fully 100% present. It's not somewhere else and it's not in some other time. We're already that. So in considering his question, I would focus on Ra's precepts of the disciplines of the personality. Know the self, accept the self, become the creator. And if we look at the first step, knowing the self, this involves observing the self. And to my way of thinking, it's not just any sort of observation, but the focused type of observing that one develops or cultivates in meditation. That is the observing using what the Buddhists call mirror mind. And in that observing, you simply witness what is arising. There's no grasping. There's no attachment. There's no holding on to anything. There's no avoiding. There's no aversion. There's no judgment or no commentary. You're just watching the self in all its nakedness and honesty. And like the mirror receives and embraces all the images that pass before it without rejection or attachment. And I think that this observation, this knowing of the self, yields great insight into how your illusory patterns of self are actually working. You becomes clearer the fear and the resistance in the mind and its patterns. But on a deeper level, you're not just seeing how your mind works, or you're not just seeing the patterns of the body, but when you develop this witnessing awareness, or rather when you recognize that this witnessing awareness is already there, that's the trick of it. You see that it's already spontaneously, effortlessly happening. It's not so much that you develop it. You realize that you are not these mental patterns. You have tension, but you are not tension. Who are you? You have expectations and disappointments, but you are not these expectations and disappointments. Who are you? Because that which is aware of the tension is not the tension. That which is aware of the fear is not the fear. So you're witnessing your non-self, so to speak. This is how I tie it into Buddhist thought about this non-self. You're witnessing this loose collection or bundle of past conditioning that you assume is a solid individual I. This separate identity consumes your attention and it becomes sticky, as Alan Watts says. The sticky property of these mental patterns causes us to identify with them. And in so doing, we create this fictional separate self that superimposes over who we really are. And in short, it creates suffering, untold suffering, because we're so identified with this I. But then to move on to Rod, the second part of Rod's precept in the disciplines of the personality is to accept the self. So you're not just observing and silently witnessing. You're accepting all that you see. Everything that you observe is run through your heart, and you forgive that material, and you forgive that self. And you don't seek to change what you witness per se. You just accept it as it is. There's no aspect of yourself, none, that is to be judged or abhorred. You are okay as you are. You are loved as you are. It is all to be accepted. And as Ra says, that which is not needed falls away. And that also is a practice, accepting yourself. You make the decision, you set the intention to accept that which comes before you, even non-acceptance itself, which is a paradoxical statement I like from Eckhart Tolle. And then Ra's third step, to become the creator. I don't know how well that one can be communicated, but...
Oh, no. I've been working with that for years, and I haven't got it yet.
Yeah, that's the mystery of it. And I would just, again, reiterate Eckhart Tolle's statement that the most important step that you can take on your spiritual journey is to disidentify from your mind. And also, I would add, you loving, embracing, and forgiving the mind-body as it is. I think when you start there, with meditation, with loving meditation, that you're well on your way to discovering who you really are and always have been, and that's the creator. And to cap my thought, I think, in truth, it's not so much that we, quote-unquote, become the creator, but rather that we drop the illusions that we are not already the creator.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the cross. That's the sacrifice. Ra says it can only be valued, manifestation can only be valued through the losing. That we drop this attachment to this separate self, and that's a death. That's a real death. And we awaken, or we resurrect, or we are reborn to who we have been all along. The camouflage is no longer there, or the camouflage has become transparent. And there's grace and humility and surrender and all that, and softness and acceptance. That's my long answer.
I like your long answer very much. Mickey, have you worked with this question yet?
Oh, I already gave my answer. You know, take the first step and keep moving.
The thing about Mick, I call Jim Mick, by the way. The thing about Mick is that in one way he's profoundly not found his Christ, shall we say. The other thing is that he profoundly is a man of faith and knows what he knows and is what he is and is very certain and sure. And I see both in him, and I cannot close the difference in any way except to say that he does it. And if he does it, then it must be so.
That's a good short way to encapsulate Jim. He does it. Jim does do it.
Will and faith. I think those are the two qualities that we're all talking about here, and exercising them continually. And not trying to judge yourself, because if you take your spiritual temperature, you're probably going to get a wrong reading. We don't see that clearly here. So, you know, just have faith and keep the will going, and we'll see what happens after we pass through the veil of forgetting.
Mm-hmm. Which most of us are all too eager to do sometimes, I think. We don't appreciate the glory of this experience of sacrifice and loss.
No, at the moment you're making the sacrifice, it seems like a bit much. It's better to look back on sacrifice.
I don't know. I've been sacrificing almost everything, and I still see the beauty of it all.
Yeah, well, that's why you're my hero, because you keep doing that every day, and I have to struggle to keep up.
Well, we are reaching the end of the show. Carla, did you want to say goodbye to everybody?
We love you all.
Indeed.
All right. Before we wrap up, a quick note that we have our homecoming happening August 29 through 31. More information on the homepage of bringforth.org under the news section. Please come and see us. You've been listening to LL Researchers in the Now, Q&A with Carla and Chris. If you've enjoyed the show, please visit our websites, llresearch.org and ringforth.org. Thanks so much for listening, and a special thank you to those who submitted questions. If you would like to submit a question for us before the next show, please read the instructions on our page at blogtalkradio.com/llresearch. Have a wonderful week. We'll be here next Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern, and we'll talk with you then.
On an island coast, and only flows I see are ghosts. I run through a wooded aisle and chase the sunlight mile after mile. And I feel like I know this place as a tree line breaks in the wide open space. I stare at a bright red sun, search all day and never find anyone. Walk on a winding road, deep in the night, near the edge of the known. I pass by moonlit lake, and the cold wind blows, and my bones start to shake. And I feel I should know this place, as the road winds on in the wide open space. The wind plays a haunting tone, and I make my way through the night all alone. Blink of an eye, I walk. planets turn and they all stop dying.